Welcome back, podcast listeners. This is Dr. Rewat Dionandian, and you are listening to the Dionandian Podcast. In today's installment, we return once more to the home of Dr. Aparna Halpe to interview her and Dr. Graham Sanders in yet another wine-fueled investigation of all that matters in the universe. Once more, we return to our favorite go-to subject, which is educational reform, but as well, we take time to venture down some other avenues, which may or may not be entertaining for you. We'll find out. All I know, it was pretty entertaining for us, and that's probably the wine talking, but I'll let you decide. Without further ado, my conversation with Drs. Aparna Halpe and Graham Sanders.
I'm once more the guest at dinner at the home of Aparna Halpe and her boy toy, Graham Sanders. And they've agreed to be interviewed once more, and poor Dr. Halpe is not feeling well. So she will be shouting commentary off from what happens on the sideways? The side, a commentary from the balcony?
The
from
peanut gallery?
The aisles.
Peanut
from the aisles?
There it is.
Peanut gallery.
So, and poor Dr. Sanders is...
horizontal.
Yeah,
for all the wrong reasons. My back has staged a rebellion against me.
The other thing that I had to point out to the listeners, all four of them, is that we're trying out some new technology today. We're wearing, Graham, what are we wearing?
Sounds like a French explorer. Lavalier.
Oh, right.
Yes. No, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, I was thinking wearing champagne.
They're looking for my St. Lawrence Channel.
That happens after the podcast goes dark.
Lavalier. I like that, Lavalier.
Lavalier.
La Luelle. Sorry, I'm getting sidetracked here by the shiny toys.
So in our last adventure together, we talked about educational reform. And today,
cheers.
So far, we've been talking about the problem. Did you hear that clink? That was the sound of wine clinking. So far, we've been talking about paradigms of belief, the problems with science in general, and the problems with public. It comes back to public education again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Graham was saying...
education in general. By saying public education, you're positing that maybe private education doesn't have this problem.
Okay, so what do we mean by private versus public education?
Well, education that's paid with your taxes or education that's paid out of your own pocket. But
I was thinking
either one.
More in terms of education that society dictates versus education done in the home.
Oh, okay.
All right, so anything that's structured and formalized would, I think there's a crisis there.
Right.
Whereas education in the home somehow in the last few generations has become less important. It shouldn't be. But it's become less important, where the things that we thought in the past used to be the responsibility of parents and family have been downloaded to state-run schools and sometimes privately run schools. Mm-hmm. Would you agree that there is a decline, perhaps, in the appropriateness of the focus in societally run schools, or a crisis in the focus?
The thing is, I don't know enough about the schools.
Oh, you're not mic'd properly here.
Actually, it looks like we're still getting your voice.
Here.
No.
You can keep it.
Keep it. It was picking me up.
All right.
Yeah.
And I'm coughing. You go ahead.
No. Well, I think a lot of it depends on what level of education you're talking about, too, right? So.
Okay.
Are we talking about post-secondary? Talking about colleges and universities, or are we talking about high schools?
Okay, so when we first talked about this, it actually goes back to the first conversation. We talked about what would be the things that everyone should know.
Right.
Remember, we began by talking about how maybe we should all know what a control group is. Mm-hmm. Maybe everyone should understand math and history and anything that's supposedly apolitical, even though you correctly pointed out that nothing's apolitical.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe what we're talking about here is the need for everyone in a society to have some basic understanding of something.
The question, of course, is what?
Yeah, what? Yeah. Because I'm going to opt for poetry. Everyone has to read poetry.
Ah, yeah. I agree.
That's not going to happen. Conspicuous silence. From Dr. Dionandis.
Imagine what that would do. You see, if everyone were required to read poetry, that means also that everyone would have to learn that there is no definitive text.
There's mm-hmm. no definitive text. But the Bible, the Bible teaches everything we need to know about everything.
No way. The Bible is narrative. As is any
actually, I mean, you know what? Having said that, narrative is more important than poetry. I can't believe I just said it, but it is.
What?
In terms of education, I think.
Because that's a method.
Because everything is delivered via narrative, whether it's scientific knowledge, political knowledge, humanities knowledge. And so to have students understand how narratives are constructed, the rhetorical devices of narratives, the purposes narratives are put to, you know, the reliability that's imputed to a narrative because it's put in a certain way. These are all important, critical tools,
does not
I think.
Teach narrative. Are there accepted templates or formats?
Well,
I mean, are these things not culturally bound?
Well, actually, that's it. Well, I mean, I think narrative is universal, right? Storytelling is universal across human culture. The tools that you want to use, the terminology, the taxonomy is going to change,
okay,
obviously.
Okay, but is it true that, you know, every story has a protagonist and a journey and a change and a denouement and a climax? Mm-hmm. Or are those, again, constructs?
Yeah, and then also if we're talking about narrative and if you're defining it that way, then scientific studies are not narratives, right?
Okay.
But scientific studies are used as evidence in narratives that are supposed to further, sure. You know, story of...
Even though scientific studies are not technically narratives and the way they're published aren't really narratives, mm. except to the extent that we say we use 8 milligrams of this and apply this
right.
test. The way that they ultimately interface with society is a narrative. Mm-hmm. So when the scientist finally goes to the policymaker and explains what they did, mm-hmm. it's told in narrative format.
Mm-hmm.
When the media talks about it, it's Dr. Such and Such, who was struggling with this idea for so long, he becomes a protagonist.
Yeah, that's true.
And every experiment is a quest myth.
A quest myth.
You begin with some hypothesis that needs to be tested, you test it.
Questmith sounds like the nerdiest name for a hip-hop star.
Questmith as scientific study is Questmith.
It has to be.
What's, if you flip that around then what's what about the scientific method would apply to a classical myth? What's the hypothesis that's being tested in a,
well,
or it's an exploration of the unknown to find out what's out there? Or,
exactly, and to present a series of possible potential eventualities and then pick the most valid.
You know, the way that documentaries talk about science is always in that way, right?
Right.
As a quest. I'm still stuck on the word quest myth. It sounds like it came with a lisp talking about December 25th. I'm looking forward to Questmith. I'm going to get so many presents at Questmith.
All I want for Questmith is my two front teeth.
And this, my friends, is why this podcast is so popular.
That's why we got. That's why three people are listening to it, including the people that are participating. Oh, there's a dog over there. Well, he actually is not listening.
He's fast asleep.
He's asleep.
He's going to start snoring anytime.
He's got some self-preservation instincts.
He's going to go off on his own quest myth.
Wow.
He's chasing little dogs.
Okay, so we're teaching kids. This is what we talked about last time, but I guess it's a question we could never be solved. So we're teaching kids initially literacy, numerical skills, I assume. Then we had an idea about whether we're teaching them social skills or moral qualities.
That's an issue.
I mean, I think actually what we're doing at a primary level is pretty good. I'm pretty satisfied with it. It's when you get into the high school, university level that things tend
to... The moral skills, though, once you're in that realm, you're into indoctrination a little bit. Are we not?
But come on.
I'm talking about
That's the best argument ever. But
yeah,
come on.
Come on. Haven't you been indoctrinated? Come on.
How can you
this is called peer pressure.
I mean, morality is indoctrination. How is it not bad?
I agree. It is indoctrination. But I guess we're accepting that. We say that's what it is.
Let's take sharing. For example, is that's indoctrination, the idea that it's better for all of us to share?
Because sharing, to put it bluntly, is a socialist perspective as opposed to a capitalist perspective. Would be, no, I don't share. You must earn what I have and offer me something in return for it.
Right.
Value laden.
Absolutely.
which is what children will naturally default to.
Really?
Well, yeah, I think so, on the playground.
Hmm. You're saying Ayn Rand was right? That
the no, I'm saying that's what we have to work against. I'm what the Chinese call a Xunzian in Confucian ethics, which is that we're all kind of selfish bastards and we need ethics to to steer
Chinese
us away from
a different
that.
Word for everything.
Where the other guy, Mengzi, says we're all good people and it's actually poor education that leads us away from being good. So we need good education in order to foster what's already in us and bring it out to its fullest potential.
Okay. What if there's nothing in us? I mean, yeah. You know, there are some people, we're all educators. We don't want to admit it, but occasionally we do come across a student, and maybe not so much occasionally, in whom there isn't as much in there as
a true tabula rasa. The problem is every time you write something on it, it just disappears. Tabula rasa and turno.
Return and return.
That's right. The self-effacing tabula rasa. It's like one of those Etch-a-Sketches. It's permanently being shaken. Obviously, we have biological needs, drives. There are things that we're already arriving in the world with that education is seeking to either control or foster.
Right. Yeah. So, in other words, is it morally acceptable that every society has defined a set of values, for lack of a better word, that they believe their educational systems should seek to inculcate or accentuate?
See, that's a problem when you're comparing societies, right?
Exactly. So, I mean, Nazi Germany had certain values that they wish to inculcate.
Or the role of women in many societies, right?
Exactly.
That, in fact, that women are excluded from education in the first place because that's not their position.
So there's a larger discussion there about does there exist a universal morality? Mm-hmm. So Dr. Halpe is shaking her head.
Yeah.
I tend to agree. I think they're I think we're inching closer to one because historically the more extreme viewpoints have been eliminated. And so we're having more homogeneous cultures now than we have in the past. But it doesn't say that there's something innate to the human animal.
But you could make an argument that we're inching closer to morality that is the successful morality of the victors.
That's right? Exactly what I'm
saying. In the economic global game.
That if there is going to be a universal morality, the precondition to that will be global capitalism.
Yeah.
Interesting. That needs to be on a t-shirt. If there is going to be a universal morality, the precondition is universal capitalism. A big t-shirt with small font. And a grumpy cat.
money rules. There's the two-word version.
That's what. But I'm telling you, many people do believe that universal morality exists.
Yes.
And I think this is the fundamental assumption we have international
as some sort of a priori.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Like the UN can exist, for example, mm-hmm. because we assume everyone believes that these are the goals that we do and should care about.
Mm-hmm.
Not that the UN is founded by the US as a way to try and control the rest of the world.
You communist.
You know, but that's not necessarily, that doesn't make it, you know,
doesn't make it wrong or right.
Uniformly wrong, yeah. But I think we should be honest about the motivations and where these institutions come from. But being horizontal and having wine is not helping my articulation.
The motivation is the key factor here, right? Every semester I teach an essay on forgiveness by June Caldwell. It was the last essay that June Caldwell wrote. It begins with a really interesting reportage of an incident in small town Ontario where a young boy whose father is a policeman, the father routinely beats him, and she itemizes it with chains, belts, sticks, and his fists because he is afraid that his boy will grow up to be gay. Now, the issue there. Now, when we read this in the classroom, when the classroom reads this, they are in shock, right? Because we all collectively now, almost universally, understand homophobia for what it is. But I have to recalibrate the argument because Joan Caldwell herself suggests that the father sincerely believed that he had to beat it out of his son. Does that make him homophobic? Or then, are we in more problematic ground about motivation, belief, and a very different and difficult kind of love that a father would have for his child, where he does not want his child, for whatever reason, to be ostracized because he's gay, etc., etc., etc.? What we, on the other hand, would consider homophobia. There you have it in a nutshell.
That's a great example. I reminded of a recent example of some media expose of some Middle Eastern culture where the girls are woken up in the middle of the night to be force-fed to make them as fat as possible, because in that culture you can't get married unless you're a fat girl who's attractive in that sense. And so the question is this a sexist anti-woman society, or is it an expression of love that I want my daughter to be happy and to find a man and be a mother and all those other things?
To be secure.
Well, it's the same with genital mutilation.
Exactly.
I mean, all these acts which are actually, who's waking up the daughters? Probably the mothers, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. And that's another problem. It becomes an inculcated culture where women are perpetrating it on women. But it always goes back to what the men want. It seems, if it's to get married, right? It's to be attractive to men.
Sure.
If it's foot binding, it's to be an attractive woman.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the larger intellectual debate here is it moral relativism or moral absolutism?
I'm sorry, if I could just jump in there. Yeah. I don't think it's about what the men want. It's about, again, man as a commodity, which women understand can be shifted and manipulated into certain positions. And women use female subjectivity to create that manipulation. That's what's going on. It's because a woman understands that she has currency when she controls a man.
But the men are economic resources that they have to control.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. Only you in this room could say that.
Wow.
Now, can I go back to the June Colwyn story?
Yes.
And this goes back to universalism and relativism. Under any circumstances, that father is homophobic, right? Whether or not he's trying to do it to save his son suffering, he is afraid of homosexuality and what that means.
He might be gay himself.
Exactly. I mean, one could posit that given the severity of his reaction, right?
But his fear of homosexuality may not be the way that we're thinking about it.
It may not be based on hatred.
Exactly. It could be based on fear of the way his son will be treated in society. Rather, he himself may not be disgusted by it. He probably is.
Mm-hmm.
It's more like, I don't want my son to be experiencing the hatred by others.
But in order to absolve him of homophobia, then you would have to say that he loves his son for the way he is, but he's trying to save his son from being mistreated in society by beating him, right? I mean,
that would be one interpretation.
Yeah, which, I don't know, that doesn't really wash for me.
It's probably not the truth.
Yeah.
But I think
what we're looking at is the fact that the truth is much more complicated than the word homophobia suggests.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, that word is insufficient to describe this situation. Because you're looking at a very complex constellation of fear, of love, of possibly closeted desires himself, of self-disgust, of externalized disgust. All of those things coagulating to projected into his son.
And also probably living in a rural setting.
There you go.
In, economically gay, depressed circumstances.
You are responsible, you brought him up there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did you hear a scream?
Yeah, I did.
I guess there are people listening to the door who are just excited by this conversation.
That's the dog.
There's a dog next door.
There's a little dog next door.
Oh, he's excited by intellectual conversation as well.
Yeah, just like that one.
Well, I mean,
so where's the thread of this conversation? We got to pick it back up again. Let's see.
Well, I was going to go with alluding it to the recent decision in provincial government to introduce consent as a teachable item in public schools.
Uh-huh.
Like what does sexual consent entail?
Right.
Now, I think everyone in this room agrees that this is an important topic.
Yeah.
And we're all pro there being more consent. However, is it not a politicized topic? And is it not a values-based topic and possibly one with cultural elements? Is it
exactly.
Yeah, although given my biases, I'd rather see consent talked about explicitly in, I don't know, forget what you called public education, you had a better term for it, society delivered or something, in an environment that's away from the home. I think that's important. That a girl should be, well, boys and girls, but in this case, girls should be taught the autonomy of their own bodies, sure. And that you know they have to give explicit permission. Sure. And that not won't be taught in the home.
You said, though, you're happy it's being discussed. It's not just being discussed, though. There is an overt template of this is appropriate behavior and this isn't.
Yeah, well, I guess when it gets down to age of consent, then you're actually trying to put a number on it, right?
But not just age of consent, is defining that this constitutes consent and this doesn't.
Yeah.
Those are fuzzy ideas, and now we're conveying to young minds that these are absolutes.
Right.
Now, it's convenient for us to think of those absolutes, but an honest intellectual would admit that, in fact, there is some blurriness here.
Well, and also there's the tacit assumption that if you're talking about age of consent, you're already saying to these young people, oh, you can have sex just as long as you do it this way. Like, that's a problem too for many parents, right? They'd rather just say, no, you shouldn't be having sex until this age. And then once you reach this age, or maybe...
Anyone listen to their parents?
Yeah, that's true. They're not going to listen to their teachers either, are they? But at least if it's brought out in the open... That a woman, it's a woman's right to demand, or maybe demand's the wrong word, to, actually, you know what, let's not put this on the women. If boys are taught that they should seek consent, or at least expect that consent is present before they proceed, that's a good conversation to have. And, you know, fine, you might have this messy thing about how that's done and so forth, but at least you lay out the principle.
Right. No objection here. Yeah. I just find it interesting that you begin by talking about the discussion needing to be had, but you quickly segue into a more didactic, this is what consent entails.
Right.
That's not a discussion.
That's a lesson. No, that's true. Yeah. So, wow, how do you build a school where everything is always discussed as a problem before you even start teaching it, right? That's...
And I have a real problem with sexuality being associated first and foremost with a problem that needs to be articulated as such and then standardized and contained. I think I see it as another form of containment.
Fascinating. Well, I'm glad you're here to contribute that element. Otherwise, it's two, like, you know, supposedly heterosexual guys. Awkward.
Now you've got me coughing.
You spill your wine.
Oh, thank you.
Careful. Yeah. That's right, podcast listeners. There's wine involved.
Absolutely.
My back hurts.
I tasted the wine store. I tasted what's that cream, liqueur cream?
Bailey's Irish cream.
Made from wine, not from whiskey.
What?
It was delicious. It tastes just like the regular Baileys.
So, and why is that an advantage to have it made from wine rather than whiskey?
So we can pretend to be more, high class. I'm having some wine.
By adding sugar and cream to your wine? I don't think so.
The price is slightly less than it was.
It was $18 for a bottle. Is that less or more? I don't know. Interesting.
All these sweet drinks, they don't do anything for me. And like so many cocktails are like really sweet. Well, I just don't have a sweet tooth, I guess.
To take it back to education, one of the fun things that I try to teach my second year class is when sugar was introduced into the overall diet.
Uh-huh,
And it's so tied with slavery and globalization again.
Yeah.
And sugar has really been part of the general diet for at the most 400 years,
right.
Probably like 200 or 300. And that, maps so well onto.
And then it goes into all these other things that it doesn't belong in.
Yeah.
Ketchup was a good example of that. The sugar level in ketchup has gone up and up and up and up and up. So then now if you have ketchup that's not sweet, it tastes weird to you. Yeah,
it's true. Yeah, I've been removing sugar from most things, and it's glorious taking sugar out of things.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You don't love sugar.
Well, wasn't that something that they realized that one of the reasons diabetes and heart disease had gone up in India was because imbibing more sugar and and fat.
It became a status thing. Diabetes and heart disease and obesity are such complicated ideas. We all think we know what the issue was for the longest time. People are mobile enough that it's the high fructose corn syrup. It's the corn and the antibiotics and the meat, and no, it's other things. And maybe it's genetic.
Or epigenetic.
It's epigenetic. There's some overall fundamental change in the way that human civilization manages its day-to-day, hour-to-hour existence.
Right.
That's qualitatively different from the way it was 3-4 generations ago. And maybe there's some theories around it, but no one's entirely certain.
And it's probably a combination of a whole bunch of things, right?
Yeah. Including the age distribution.
Yeah.
We're much older now. Kind of forget that part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's freaky.
Aw. Poor cough.
You guys are your coughing.
Croaky and creaky. Croaky and creaky.
So before we started this process, we were talking about homeopathy.
Ah,
because you know we're deep down, we're homosexuals.
I thought we were hobosexuals.
That's only when we're when we're hopping trains.
Professor or hobo? It's hard to tell.
You've been to the website, right? Professor or hobo?
By the way, I see you haven't jumped on the beard bandwagon. Do you ever grow a beard? Can you grow a beard?
I grew one last year.
You did? No, I didn't see it.
Out of curiosity, and shaved it. Right, I look like a terrorist.
Did you look like Gaius Baltar?
The original or the...
He grew a beard at one point during that.
Yeah. My beard's entirely white, so it aged for 10 years. And you know, I'm a beautiful man. And to cover a third of my face is just
fine.
Right. Nobody reacts. Interesting. No, I'm a brown guy. I can grow a beard in a week.
And you look like a terrorist.
In fact, when I was in my 20s, I grew a big, thick beard briefly when I was an undergrad, and back then it was not common. I had a class at Convocation Hall, and for listeners who don't know where that is, it's a big...
He's assuming they're listeners. That's so cute.
So when my mother listens to this later on, I've explained it.
That's right.
It's a big hall at the University of Toronto, and I took second
year... There like 1,000 people.
Yeah, first year political science was taught there. Mm-hmm. So I took a class there, and I would go to the top balcony, and I usually fall asleep because it's boring.
Yeah,
it was Janice Stein taught that class. She's not boring. I mean, she's fascinating. But for some reason, I fell asleep.
Yeah, she's so far away. It's such a big hall. Yeah.
And I would snore.
Right.
And I am a big snorer. And people would look up and they'd see the terrorist alone on the balcony
snoring. He's a lazy terrorist.
Terrorism wasn't as... It was always a bad thing, but it didn't have quite the stigma.
It was always a bad thing.
Well, there was that movie, one of these teenage sex movies where the guy was pretending to be a terrorist to meet girls. It was a comedy, and it would work. Alphonse, I'm in a terrorist from Algeria. And the girls
an exotic profession.
Yeah. Exactly. Mm. Anyway, to answer your
question. Well, that's what's happening with ISIS right now. All these young people are going off because they think it's cool and joining it. It's weird.
You know, there's a group in Toronto called the Institute for Clinical Evaluative Sciences, ISIS.
And they had to change their name.
They haven't, but you know, my Muslim students who want jobs there are a little concerned.
Right.
I don't want to be a Muslim working for ISIS.
So the beard, why is it white? Because you've got thick black hair. So why is your beard white?
Well, you know, my pubes are red, so...
Oh.
I'm kidding. I'm joking. Mostly. You got those. It's an audio podcast.
Is there a flag that's red, white, and black?
Yeah, I think it's a plague flag. There's hemorrhagic fever in this house.
Where's the vexologist? Vexiologist?
Vexologist.
The science of getting annoyed. Vexologist. Okay, you were starting to...
I was going
back
on tangent,
the, back on
tangent
it.
For us.
Okay.
Because I saw Gilbert...
Oh, it was homeopathy.
Homeopathy.
But okay, but now it's Gilbert
we'll go back
Gottfried.
To
okay.
Because I saw Gilbert Gottfried.
He's the opposite of homeopathy.
Well, he's something. And I've been fascinated by stand-up comedy for a long time. In fact, Graham went and saw my one attempt to simulate it once. We won't talk about that.
Yeah. It was one of the story. It was like The Moth. It was a storytelling thing.
It was a storytelling thing, but with a comedic flavor to it. And
Right. Yeah,
we won't do it. It wasn't good. So, but stand-up comedy is an art form. Mm-hmm. And an art form that's deeply seated in
form. Timing.
Narrative. Oh.
Sorry.
Oh, my space are taken. So, in narrative.
I'm like, this is like the worst podcast ever. You're coughing, and I'm like horizontal. Just okay. Anyway, back to.
I think we chose the wrong imbibement. We should have been, had inhaled this
last time. Last time it was wine. Last time wasn't it?
It was wine.
Last or was
time
it whiskey? Okay. Comedy, art form,
okay,
narrative.
So to me,
oh, I see what you're doing.
Every kind of communication is narrative. Oh, shit. Right,
yeah.
But we, but to get back to the idea of, is there a universal narrative?
Mm-hmm.
We tend to think about, you know, a protagonist,
or is narrative universal? Oh, no, the universal narrative.
Universal narrative.
Oh, okay.
Right? And so when stand-up comedy, you get the people who tell the joke. Guy walks into a bar,
right?
Or you've got the individual experience. Ever notice how? Mm. You know? Or you've got
us against them.
Or us against them.
Yeah.
Or like Stephen Wright's, who just say strange things,
right,
strange turns. Are those forms of narrative, or are they just wordplay?
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I ask is, to me, the art form of stand-up comedy is the experimental laboratory for communication in general, which segues into education and pedagogy. How's that for being intellectual sounding?
So we should get them to, well, you use Segway.
Yeah, not Segway, though. That would have been better if I used Segway.
So we should get the kids to stand up and tell jokes.
I wish. That would be a great assignment.
But for the kids to stand up and tell the jokes, they need to be able to understand the architecture, the structure, which is what you're talking about. Now, I would...
And have some empathy to their with their audience, too.
Well, that's essential. You cannot...
Yeah.
You cannot... tell a narrative without empathy, otherwise you're talking to yourself, and that's not, unless that's what you intend to do. But so I would say that there are structures. There are what, I mean, this is not me, right? This is Fry. There are archetypes which you pick and manipulate according to your will.
Doesn't Fry believe that the archetypes are biblical?
Sadly, but he didn't really His understanding of archetypes is a bit limited.
Wow, Dr. Halpern just laid the smack down.
Yeah. The guy's dead. He can't even defend himself.
That's heavy.
You,
I bet it was.
You fried Fry.
Yeah.
He's incredible, but...
I didn't read The Great Code, but was he claiming that the Bible generated these narratives, or the Bible is just a very salient exemplar of these narratives?
Yeah,
the Doberman disagrees with me. Or is it a Rottweiler? Rottweilers are notorious for postmodernness.
Why are you thinking about it? Let me tell you about North
Fry. Zizek and Rottweiler.
Because I was a student at Victoria College, and I was a scholarship winner. And
how many places have you defamed?
Defame. I'm going to need you to remember. I don't know the lyrics of the defame.
So it's gone up in my estimation.
And as a scholarship winner, we'd have these regular scholarship dinners, and Northrop Frye came to all of them to meet the first-year students.
Right.
And we didn't know who he was because we're a bunch of stupid first-year students.
He probably liked that.
Possibly.
I mean, see, if you want to talk about education, you got to talk about Frye. Because the man clearly had a passion for it. And that... That is exactly his approach. He started with the most remote person in the institution, the stranger, the one.
And then he didn't
through the door.
And he didn't have contempt for his students.
Not at all.
Yeah, I see that as a problem.
Contempt for students.
Yeah.
Yeah. I see.
I slip into it, and it's not. I don't like it in myself, and I see it in other people.
I only do it on Facebook.
Yeah.
One person.
What is a pose for you? On Facebook, or you suppose with your students?
I let off some steam on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not contempt for the students. It's contempt for a system that produced them this way.
Mm-hmm.
It's not their fault.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's not their fault.
No.
I just have little patience for the utilitarian attitude towards education, that I have to get this grade because I need to get this and I need to get this. But there's a lot of economic pressure
exactly.
on these students, right? So
they're
so it that trickles backwards converts everything into, you know, a means to this end.
Right? I ignore that noise. Like, mm-hmm. I understand they need the marks and stuff. That's a separate compartmentalized discussion that I have with them.
That actually may be a healthy way to do it, to just say, okay, that's that over there. Let's set that aside. Now let's talk about what you're actually learning over here.
Yeah. And then I tell them that I don't care about your exams. For me, getting you to writing the exam is my job. Like, we talked about this stuff. The fact that you're going to write the exam means I've already won. Mm-hmm. Now, regardless of how you do, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. I wrote the exam. You learned something in class. Mm-hmm. How you do is irrelevant. Of course, I don't agree with that because they're going off to get a medical school.
They have to get that scholarship.
That's where my mental process is.
Well, see, I'm in a very interesting position because what I do has absolutely no use value at all.
Well, not proximal value.
No, it has no use value.
Not even
for whom?
My students are forced to take a course in English. That they will never use again.
Use English. They write.
But they will never write at the kind of caliber that I demand that they write in my class.
But the fact that you've stretched them will improve their writing in other circumstances.
Is, why bother? And they ask me this question all the time. Why bother?
I have an answer for you. You bother because hearing you correctly, what you're teaching is the mechanics of writing.
I do, but I think far more importantly, I use the mechanics of writing to teach them to be acutely critical of the world that they live in.
Well, that's fantastic. In that case, you've done more for them than I have, for sure, by teaching, you know, statistical tests or whatever.
Today's Saturday, but your last lecture that you gave where you were talking about Africa. How did Africa come up?
Well, we were dealing with an extract from Ramirez, Shake Hands with the Devil, and
about the Rwandan genocide.
And I just threw out a general question to my students, asking them, why do you think everybody ignored Rwanda when it started to happen, right? And then I had a student who was Caucasian, and she said, well, everyone ignores Africa. So I said, well, let's start there. What is Africa? And suddenly all my African students looked up. Mm. You know, until that point, they had, I think, assumed that there was no productive conversation to be had about this. And I think it was important for them to finally hear somebody standing at the podium acknowledge the fact that there is no such thing as Africa, that it is a construction, and it's a colonial construction and a matter of convenience. It was equally important for my Caucasian student to hear that too. And I think it was really interesting because one of my students who's from Nigeria, she said, you know, we've got a lot of students, international students here from Africa. And what most people don't even realize is that we don't even speak each other's languages. We have no idea what the other person is thinking or saying or doing. We have nothing in common.
Yeah, they're all lumped into this label of Africa. Yeah.
African international students.
Then how can you say that you've done nothing for them? Like, this strikes to me that you contributed more to their growth as individuals and functioning adults, members of society.
But I love my job.
Yeah.
Even though my job exists on the margin and is probably about to disappear. Right? Because increasingly we are being told that the humanities is of absolutely no value. We are being told that this kind of approach to teaching, one that questions and continues to question, needs to be standardized so that we can construct so-called learning outcomes where every single student taking this course at different places and stages in their university career will be guaranteed to have the same result. Well, you can't guarantee the result of a Socratic method. That's the whole point, that you do not guarantee.
This is probably the most essentially important question of our time, I believe, is how to value educational instruments. And I think one of the problems here is, well, several problems. One of them is the electoral cycle, limited 4 years of thinking, 8 years of thinking, 10 years of thinking, and our inability to understand the art and science of evaluation. Mm-hmm. It's not about indicators, necessarily.
Yeah.
There's an overall humanistic, holistic, comprehensive perspective. You can never assess the quality and importance of your teaching until you ask that person at the end of their 90 years of life.
Yeah.
So how did that affect you?
That's right.
And they may not even realize explicitly what they've learned and how that's helped them later in life, because they don't tie it. It's just they've internalized it, and it just becomes part of their outlook in the world. So you can't like sort of tease it out and say, okay, that part of your insight was tied back to this particular course. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not ideally you wouldn't be able to do that, because if you can do that, then you're just teaching skills. Yeah. Right?
Although I do get excited. I mean, every so often I've had students. I mean, supposedly I was teaching literature, and yet my students end up going into these amazing places. Like, I had a student suddenly ask me for a reference because she was going to take up humanitarian law in Bhopal, India. Mm-hmm. Right? And this is a kid from Scarborough who decided she's going to up and move to Bhopal to law. Because,
is she Indian?
No. She's Bangladeshi, as far as I could tell. Mm-hmm. Canadian born.
Same thing. I'm kidding. No, I'm
what
kidding.
Is India? What is India?
Don't get me started.
You're Indian too, right? She's Sri Lankan.
You're all so. South Asian.
We're all brown. Brownies.
We're all coconuts.
Coconut.
Coconut.
That's interesting. So, you know, we're at the 40-minute mark.
Okay.
We'll end it soon. But I want to ask you.
So we've lost all our listeners by now, but. It's a.
River, did you chew this?
No, the dog chewed it. It's a back
support. Dogulous.
So Dr. Yeah. Sanders here is laying on my back support, which is missing like a chunk out of it, and the dog.
It's a pair. Pair of spheres.
Yeah. It was delicious, though, I gotta say. So there's a question.
Yeah, spheres is delicious.
There's a before we had pie. There's a question on my.
Is it floor pie?
The most important human being who'd ever lived.
Oh, gosh.
And I narrowed it down to 5 people. Mm. Of course, my particular criteria was pretty specific. Mm. It must be, you know, some obvious measurable impact and on the things that I cared about. And I cared about, you know, technology, learning,
Bacon.
Peace, whatever it might be, understanding the world. And I won't tell you my top 5 yet, but can you throw some names out at me? The people you think in the history of humankind who have been most impactful. Maybe I will give you my top 5.
Yeah, I got to think about that. That's.
I mean, sadly, there's some caveats and biases. One of them is that we only know about the people we know about.
Yeah, that's true.
And so we're biased towards those who have we have records of.
Right.
As Westerners, we are always biased towards those that are written about in the English language. Of course, you read probably in Chinese, and so you have access to that world as well. As well, certain kinds of demographics were more likely to be allowed to contribute.
Yeah, they'll mostly be men. Yeah. Right,
exactly. So this is not to say that other people did not contribute, but my list is based on those that we know about most prominently.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got it down to, I think, I had Newton, Darwin.
Darwin has to be on there, I think. Darwin. Yeah.
I didn't put Einstein on there, but I had Tesla on there.
Mm. Huh.
And I think my number one was Socrates.
Right. What about Karl Marx?
Karl Marx, no. And I'll tell you why, no.
Jesus Christ was ahead of Karl Marx.
Yeah, exactly. Jesus Christ. I'm not entirely sure there's evidence Jesus Christ existed.
Whatever that historical figure was.
Yeah.
Already had the prototype for what
exactly.
communism would become.
With Karl Marx, I mean, communism.
But explicitly, the Marxist doctrine has affected billions of people, right?
Temporarily, pretty much. Mm. You know, the communist states have mostly, quote-unquote, fallen. And I would say Marx's greatest impact is in economics, in understanding that, you know, labor is an asset.
Mm-hmm.
100 years from now, I don't think we'll talk about Marx. 100 years from now, we'll talk about anything, so we'll be dead. But other people won't be talking about Marx.
Yeah, you don't think so? That's interesting. Well, I don't know. Confucius is big up there, I think. I really want to put a woman on that list. The problem is a lot of the contributions of women would have been erased.
Yeah.
Either hidden in the first instance or not recorded.
Exactly. That's the big bias we have here. I mean, the guy who invented, or woman who invented the wheel, for God's sake, probably changed the world more than anybody else, but we don't know who that was.
Right. Yeah.
So we're limited by historical records.
Huh. I always feel like
Fred Astaire.
Fred Astaire.
If you didn't hear that, Dr. Hoppe said Fred Astaire. Why? Why is that a part of
it? So this is a Fred Astaire poster above her desk.
The man was perfect. What could I say? As a just a singular symbol of joy, of hope, of.
But changed the world more than anybody else, impacted the world than anybody else?
All over the world, they wanted to dance like that guy.
I don't think most people know who he is or that he existed.
Maybe not now, not that way.
Also, the other problem is a lot of the world-changing technologies, let's say technologies, take that as one rather than idea. Well, technologies are ideas, but you know what I mean, something concrete. Can't be attributed to one person.
Right.
Right. So
one person could be a symbol of that.
Indoor plumbing, I mean, that's probably saved, you know, untold lives, but you can't say one person invented indoor plumbing.
So I mean, to flip the question over, isn't, you know, what is the greatest impactful thing in the world that it's attributed to? It's for the people we know about who has been the most impactful.
I know this sounds incredibly reactionary, but the old JC, man, I mean.
OJC?
Jesus Christ.
Right? Oh, the old JC.
The old JC.
No, actually, yes, Jesus Christ, absolutely. Include on that list.
For all sorts of reasons. I mean, not necessarily, I'm not saying this necessarily as a positive thing, but the ideology launched in the shadow of this figure, it's something we're still trying to come to terms with.
No, once you mention his name, I realized that was the biggest omission on my list. Absolutely. On my list as well was Genghis Khan.
Mm. Yeah. But you know what? The Mongol Empire is a flash in the pan. It's 100 years. It's 100 years from its beginnings for some tribe out in the backwaters to when it's gone.
But the damage they did brought down empires that haven't recovered since.
Right, that's true. But then you're trying to prove a negative, to some extent. So, what could have been if they hadn't?
Why not Christopher Columbus?
Yeah, Columbus was on my list. He was top 10. Because I would think the most important moment in history was, in fact, 1492, when Columbus arrived in New World. I've always said that.
Even though that's all kind of BS?
He definitely arrived.
But, yeah, but there are other people arrived before him, people arrived after him.
His arrival was the most impactive. Sure, Leif Erikson arrived, but who cares?
What about this Amerigo Vespucci guy?
He arrived, nobody cares, right? The point is, when he arrived, things happened.
Well, then, we might be attributing too much agency to the individual, right? Yeah, there could be a whole confluence of...
That's why I'm not a fan of Columbus necessarily, because he just sent some ships over.
Right.
He wasn't the one who did all this stuff. Whereas Socrates, I think his ideas, his example, were specific to him and were profoundly impactful.
Yeah, I'd plump for Socrates.
Reason, though, Aristotle, because without poetics, we would... I don't know what narrative would look like.
Aristotle, really.
Perhaps.
Well, all of medieval learning is basically.
No, all of learning.
Yeah.
Goes back to the poetics.
Mm-hmm.
So.
That never occurred to me.
Who would have gone on our list now? We've got Aristotle and Socrates, if we're letting Aristotle on. Darwin, Jesus Christ. So we got room for one more.
Well, we're very Western centric.
Yeah. So it's got to stick Confucius on there. What about Buddha?
The Buddha.
See, once again, I'm not...
But then what the Buddha did was not necessarily original.
Yeah, exactly. I think we're ascribing too much importance to individuals sometimes because...
I understand what you're saying, but others may have done it for him, but maybe when he did it, it actually meant something. Right?
Or... That movements need an individual to coalesce around at some point. At the right time. In order to go to that next level.
Back to quest myths and heroes. We need to constellate whatever these movements are around a figure. The figure has the figurehead.
Well, because we're all individuals, so we can relate. Are you going to relate better to an idea, or are you going to relate to an individual?
Journalism 101.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. That's your lead.
An easier question is kind of, you know, who's the most formative personality of the 20th century?
Formative personality.
Or impactful individual. Or 1,000 years from
impactful.
Now.
Impactful. You're using the word impactful?
In lack of a better word. So 1,000 years from now, yeah. Like every century, who defined that century?
20th century?
Yeah.
20th, yeah.
Sadly, Hitler.
I would agree.
Yeah.
Or Stalin.
Yeah. Yeah. Not Mao.
I think Mao might eventually define the 21st century.
Whoa!
Who killed more people? That's the question.
Mao defining the 21st century.
No, because already by the 21st century, Mao is discredited even in China as a historical relic. Yeah. It had to be revised and whitewashed and footnoted. And
that's how my students describe me. Historical relic was whitewashed. All right. Well, you know what? I think I've bored you guys enough. And it's.
Is anyone listening live?
No.
Okay.